morning, Africa, and welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm Jackson Vunganyi in Washington. Today is Thursday, January the 13th, and here are some of the stories we're covering for you this morning. Somali terrorist group Al-Shabaab has claimed responsibility for a bombing Wednesday near the capital's international airport that killed at least 9 people.
The security agencies will investigate the target of attack and will share the outcome when we have finalized the inquiry.
Uganda's army says its military forces and the Congolese army are having great success in the joint operation against the rebel outfit, the Allied Democratic Forces, that is mainly based in the DR Congo.
The commander, all the commanders, are totally separated from their forces.
That is Brigadier Flavia Biekwaso, Uganda's army spokesperson. A summit of the Southern African Development Community, SADC, has ended in Malawi with a pledge from member states to continue fighting insurgents in Mozambique. We'll have these stories and more coming up right here on Daybreak Africa. Stay tuned. And for our top story, Somali terrorist group Al-Shabaab has claimed responsibility for a bombing Wednesday near the capital's international airport that killed at least 9 people. Mohamed Kahiye spoke to authorities and witnesses in this report from Mogadishu.
Somalia's police force spokesman Al-Fatah Hassan Ali confirmed the casualties were a result of a suicide attacker who detonated a car bomb. He says before they used it to target security agencies and government officials, but that is over today, and the target is Somali civilians. Mogadishu Deputy Mayor Aliyere Ali said he survived the Wednesday attack and that the security agencies have launched an investigation. He says the security agencies will investigate the target of the attack and will share the outcome when we have finalized the inquiry. We asked the security agencies to beef up the security. He added that the enemy cannot intimidate us. Terrorist group Al-Shabaab claimed the responsibility for the attack, which it said targeted a convoy carrying foreigners. The claim could not be independently verified. Deadly blast comes just days after Somali leaders agreed to hold long-delayed elections in February after a dispute that widened a rift between the president and the prime minister. Analysts have been warning that Al-Shabaab will take advantage of the political tensions and any perceived power vacuum to launch attacks. The U.S. Embassy in Somalia condemned the Wednesday terrorist attack. Mohamed Kaye for VOA News in Mogadishu, Somalia.
A summit of the Southern African Development Community, SADC, has ended in Malawi with a pledge from member states to continue fighting insurgents in Mozambique. SADC sent troops to Mozambique last year after the Islamist radicals began terrorizing residents of northern Cabo Delgado province. Southern African leaders say they have made progress in fighting the insurgents, but security experts note that there are still challenges and that dialogue should be an option. Lamek Masina reports from Blantyre, Malawi.
In his closing remarks on the summit Wednesday, SADC chairperson and the Malawian president Lazarus Chakwera said the summit confirmed the commitment SADC leaders have made to ensure that the region remains peaceful, stable and secure. He said the summit provided an opportunity to review the mandate of the SADC mission in Mozambique in combating terrorism and acts of violent extremism.
A particular note is the fact that today we took a bold and decisive step to extend the mission in Mozambique so that we are able to consolidate and sustain the gains we have made thus far. Until victory and peace is secured, we will not relent, we will not regress, and we will not retreat.
Chakwera said similar SADC interventions had succeeded in the past.
We stood together during the liberation struggle against formidable colonial powers, and we prevailed. We stood together whenever any part of our region was ravaged by natural disasters, and we prevailed. We stood together to defend our region against COVID-19 pandemic despite our limited resources, and we will prevail.
However, security expert Sherif Kaisi, a former military officer with the Malawi Defense Forces, says there are still challenges in Mozambique and insists dialogue should be an option. He said the challenge is that SADC are fighting militias who are always in civilian clothes, making them difficult to identify.
So the heads of state should not just stick their guns to the, you know, combating that through arms, but other avenues, like sitting down. Even labels, they are human beings. If you dehumanize them, the war is going to continue and many people lose their lives.
Media reports in Mozambique says almost 1 million people have been displaced and more than 3,000 civilians killed since the conflict started. In his remarks during the opening of the summit Tuesday, the chairperson for the SADC organ on politics, defense and security cooperation, South African President Cyril Ramaphosa, said the situation in Cabo Delgado province has now improved. He cited the return of internally displaced people to their home areas and the provision of humanitarian assistance to the affected families. Lamek Masina for VOA News, Blantyre, Malawi.
In Tanzania, the debate over foreign loans continues, especially after President Samia Suluhu Hassan stressed their importance for national development and mocked government critics for the country's international debt. Reporter Id Wesu has more from Dar es Salaam.
It is a debate that continues to evoke different emotions across the country, with argument both for and against the use of loans and grants. Dr. Abel Kinyondo is a professor of economics at Tumaini University, Dar es Salaam College. He says Tanzania needs loans for development. He says, however, that the government must be careful when determining the type of loans it applies for. He strongly discourages commercial loans because they are short-term and have high interest rates. But concessionary loans are paid over a long term, which can be repaid without affecting other things. He adds that money earned after the project is completed and starts working will go towards paying back the debt. However, President Samia Suluhu says that the government will continue considering loans that accelerate the implementation of development projects and explained that those who are hampering such efforts are likely to run for office in 2025. Nitajitahidi ninavyoweza. She says that she will do her best to use every opportunity she can to develop Tanzania. She says it's part of her vow to serve the country and not because of the upcoming elections in 4 years. Dr. Kinyondo explains that the decision on loans also involves the legislature. So if it appears that a certain loan may not be productive for the nation, Parliament may not approve it.
Unataka mradi wa kimkakati, sio tu uwekwe, lakini uwekwe katika mu.
He says that every project has a timeline to be completed. So loans help those strategic projects to be finished on time rather than using internal funds, which take long time to collect. According to Dr. Kinyondo, loans that will generate or stimulate economic growth are fine, unless they are for projects that are inefficient and not productive. He says it's for these reasons that the government must exercise caution when chooses among various ventures. Reporting for Daybreak Africa, I'm Idi Weso in Dar es Salaam, Tanzania.
Uganda says that its army, the Uganda People's Defense Forces, and the Congolese army are jointly having great success in their operation against the rebel outfit, the Allied Democratic Forces, or ADF, that is mainly based in Congo. Uganda's army spokesperson says that their armies have captured the main rebel camps in the DR Congo. As reporter Mugume Davis Rwakarinji has more from Kampala, Uganda.
In a joint press statement released by the spokespersons of both Uganda and DR Congo armies, the two forces said they are having great success in operation against the ISIS-linked rebels, the Allied for Democratic Forces, or ADF, in DR Congo. Brigadier Flavia Biekwaso, Uganda Army spokesperson, said the Uganda People's Defense Forces, or UPDF, and First Army, the Republic Democratic du Congo, or FARDC, have since December captured or destroyed more than 6 rebel camps.
In military operations or in any operation, the headquarters would be the last thing anyone would want to fall, because it has the commander, it has the documents, it has the records, it has a lot.
Biakwaso said the joint operation had captured the rebel headquarters, Kambi ya Yua, another camp she described as a major rebel camp called Madina. She said the armies also captured the ADF bases Belu 1, Belu 2, Mombasa, Kambi Erumu, situated in eastern DR Congo, among others.
So those are very significant achievements, that we have ably disrupted them, that we have ably made sure they cannot converge anymore, that we can ably track their communication, so meaning they cannot communicate anymore.
Security analyst Charles Romoshana disputes Brigadier Biakwaso's claims. He says he believes that is one of the guerrilla tactics the rebels are employing to avoid head-to-head confrontation against a highly equipped Uganda and DRC forces.
You see, you go to their camp, you find they have rebel left. That's a failure. That's not success. You should have struck them before they leave.
Romoshana says Biakwaso should provide all details, including weapons captured and casualties inflicted on the rebels, substantiate her claims. The operation against the ADF in DR Congo started late last year after the rebels were involved in a series of bomb blasts in Uganda in the last quarter of the year. This is what Kampala resident Norman Turiatemba says about Uganda's army in neighboring DR Congo.
The PDF occupation of Congo does not make Ugandans any safer, because history has shown that wherever we go and fight, Ugandans become more insecure. Being in Congo actually causes more harm to Ugandans than any kind of solution. So we believe we are better off keeping here and trying to create other ways of dealing with insurgencies.
It is not the first time the Ugandan army has entered DR Congo, in what they said is aimed at, in two quotes, flushing out the ADF rebels. They were in DR Congo in the late 1990s and early 2000s. The International Court of Justice, ICJ, ruled in 2005 that Uganda was under obligation to pay some $10 billion as reparations DRC for the injury caused for violation of human rights and plundering DR Congo's resources. For VOA News, I am Mugume, Davis Rwakarinji in Kampala, Uganda.
A new report from Women Beyond Walls looks at the state of women in prisons around the world and the groups that serve them, which the report says are massively underfunded. Sabrina Martani, a curator for the group, spoke to Ricky Shryok about the state of women in prisons in sub-Saharan Africa.
Well, unfortunately, there's just a huge lack of data concerning women's incarceration on the continent. It's really hard to find, you know, thorough research and statistics. This also, you know, extends to children living in prison with a parent. The little data that there is, like in a report in 2015 by Penal Reform International in Uganda, there were over 200 children detained with a parent. In Sierra Leone, where I've worked for a long time, 88% of women who were interviewed in 2019 had children outside of prison. So most women were mothers. And that's also important to remember. It's not only the children who are detained with their mothers, but also so many children who are left outside. And in most countries, there's no universal laws, but mothers are allowed to keep their children in prison if they're breastfeeding. And then again, you know, rules do vary, but when they're around 2 years old or 3 years old, they then might be taken out either to families, or if there's no family who's willing to sort of take care of them, they'll be sent to an orphanage or a state institution. And this, of course, is extremely traumatic for both the mother and their child. And if you do look at the research, women are mostly imprisoned for non-violent or minor offences. And so we really need to look at other solutions.
What alternatives do you guys think should be proposed instead of sending women to prison?
It's really to look at what are the underlying causes of women coming into contact with the law in the first place. And if we look at that, it's really poverty. I think the vast majority of these cases were criminalizing poverty or its abuse. Most women who come into prison have suffered some form of abuse, or it's mental health issues. And I think, you know, we need to ask ourselves, why are we criminalizing women for these instances when most often the state has failed them and it's society that's failed them. And really community-based solutions across the world have been shown to be much more effective, where women can be with their families, they can receive support they need to deal with underlying issues, and, you know, there's less harm on their children. And actually, it's not even less costly for society, it's less costly for the state. Secondly, if we do have to look at alternatives, then I think trying to look at aspects like bail, just making sure that women are not in pretrial detention.
The report also highlights that there are many organizations trying to serve women who are in the criminal justice system, but that these organizations often go underfunded. What kind of services go missing due to this underfunding?
So in the report, we interviewed 34 organizations from 24 countries spanning 5 continents. And the majority of these organizations, no matter where they were facing precarious funding situations. So 26% said they may not be able to operate next year due to lack of funds. And 30% said they'd have to make cuts but would survive. And this applies to all services. So whether it's a legal service, whether it's an economic empowerment service, whether it's sort of research and advocacy, trying to change some of the systemic issues around women in the criminal justice system.
That was Sabrina Martani, a curator for Women Beyond Walls. She was speaking to Ricky Shryok from Zambia. Power supply has been restored in all parts of Kenya, which earlier experienced nationwide outages after a high-voltage transmission line connecting the capital broke. Mohamed Yusuf reports from Nairobi.
Blackouts were reported in many parts of Kenya after the power line fell to the ground in Nairobi. At least 25 million people have lost power in Nairobi, Western and Central Kenya, the Rift Valley region and the Nyanza region. State-controlled Kenya Power said in a statement that electricity has since been restored to all parts of the country. Earlier, Kenya Power blamed the outage on a tower collapse along the Kiembere-Embakasi transmission line. Kenyans depend on Kenya Power, the main electricity provider in the country. In December, another power line in the town of Suswa collapsed, resulting in power rationing across the country. In May 2020, a geothermal power plant about 75 kilometers outside Nairobi broke down, leaving much of the country without power for hours. Mohamed Yusuf for VA News, Nairobi.
And let's go to South Africa, where the man charged with arson for burning down parts of the country's historic parliament building has also been charged with terrorism. Vicky Stark reports from Cape Town, South Africa.
49-year-old Zandile Christmas Mafe made his second appearance in court Tuesday. He's now facing several charges related to the fire, including terrorism, arson, breaking and entering, and theft. Mafe was arrested shortly after the fire erupted at the Parliament buildings in Cape Town in the early hours of January 2nd. He was allegedly found with laptops, documents and crockery in his possession. Prosecutors now say he was also in possession of an explosive device, hence the additional terrorism charge. In his first court appearance, his lawyer denied all charges against him. Mafe has since changed lawyers and is now being represented by the famous Dali Mpofu, who is affiliated with the left-wing Economic Freedom Fighters political party. Mpofu has also been representing the country's former president, Jacob Zuma, who was jailed for contempt of court. Mafe's bail hearing was postponed till the 11th of February, and he will be detained in a psychiatric institute. It was revealed that he'd already been sent for psychiatric observation on January 3rd and was diagnosed with paranoid schizophrenia. The estimated damage to the Parliament complex is just over $14 million. That excludes the cost of movable assets inside, like computers and furniture. Vicky Stark for VOA News, Cape Town, South Africa.
A freelance journalist for the New York Times went on trial Wednesday in Zimbabwe, accused of helping two of the newspaper's reporters enter the country illegally. Critics say that the charges are another example of the government's attempts to control the media. Columbus Mavunga reports from Harare.
At the commencement of Jeffrey Moyo's trial Wednesday, Doug Coltart, a lawyer with the Zimbabwe Lawyers for Human Rights, voiced optimism his client would be found not guilty. Coltart spoke to VOA from the city of Bulawayo, where the trial is taking place.
The state has now called about three witnesses The case against Jeff is a weak one, and it's not just us who are saying that, but the state themselves have said in papers filed before the High Court in his bail appeal that the state's case is on very shaky ground. The evidence against Jeff is incredibly weak, and essentially there's no evidence of any wrongdoing. We will see how the court proceedings play out.
Ngoye was arrested last year together with a Zimbabwe Media Commission official, Thabang Manika, for allegedly processing fake accreditations for two South African-based New York Times journalists who entered Zimbabwe and were later deported. Ngoye and Manika are being tried separately. Zimbabwe's government has dismissed accusations it disregards media rights and freedom. It says Ngoye and Manika broke immigration laws. The New York-based Committee to Protect Journalists is urging prosecutors to withdraw the charges against Ngoye. Angela Quintal, its Africa program coordinator, said this week on Twitter that failure to do so would reinforce what she called perceptions that prosecutors are acting in bad faith and using Ngoye as an example to censor and intimidate Zimbabwe's press. Thabane Ngoye of Zimbabwe Institute of Southern Africa, who is no relation to Jeffrey Ngoye, has been critical of Ngoye and Manika's arrest.
There must be fair trial on the matter, and that fairness is at the center of our justice system.
The New York Times quoted executive editor Dean Barquette as saying, "We are deeply troubled by the prosecution of Jeffrey Ngoye, which appears designed to chill press freedom in Zimbabwe. Jeffrey is a widely respected journalist with many years of reporting experience in Zimbabwe." Earlier this week, Luke Malaba, Zimbabwe's Chief Justice, told journalists that all cases brought before the courts will be treated fairly.
Efficiency entails performance at the highest level possible using the available resources. It is a legal imperative that is imposed on the courts. Section 164 of the Constitution requires the courts, in addition to being independent and impartial, to apply the law expeditiously without fear, favor, or prejudice.
Manika's trial is expected to start on Friday. Manika and Ngoye face up to 10 years in prison if convicted. Columbus Mavungam for VOA News, Harare.
And that's it for this edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for spending this morning with us. For more news and features, visit our website at voanews.com. We're also on all social media platforms, Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube. Just search for VOA Africa. Until next time, I'm Jackson Vunganyi in Washington, wishing you a very good morning, Africa.
Hello, I'm Douglas Impoga, host of VOA's Reporters Roundtable. Join us every Thursday as we discuss important African topics and events. I'll have a panel of African journalists and expert guests to discuss the topic at hand. We take a deeper look at important African news topics. That's Reporters Roundtable every Thursday at 17:30 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.
Hey, sports fans, brighten your day by tuning in to the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/VOA Sunny and on Twitter at VOA Sunny Sports. Or check out the blog at blogs.voanews.com/sunny. It's the sunny side of sports right here on the Voice of America.
VOA brings you the best in African music on the African beat. African Beat showcases the latest and the greatest of contemporary African music, from bobo music to hip life, bonga flavor to soukous, Afrobeat to ndombolo and makossa to kwaito. The African beat on VOA has it all. and it's happening right here, Mondays through Fridays at 09:05 and 20:05 UTC, right after